Our guest believes modern medicine is overly focused on seeking cures rather than taking the time to support healing and quality of life.
The data is very clear that most of actual health does not come from going to your doctor and getting a diagnosis or a treatment.
Dr. Wayne Jonas is an expert in integrative health and whole person care delivery and a widely published scientific investigator.
I learned that they were using things that I had never heard of before, such as an herb for depression, the number one prescription item for depression, St. John's Wort. Acupuncture was routinely used for pain and pain management.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Jonas, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's great to be here, especially to talk to folks like you who have built a tremendous community health centers that deliver whole person care, the topic we're going to talk about. So glad to be able to talk to you.
Well, you are the best-selling author, so we know many are familiar with your views, but let's just start out by asking, when you're talking about integrative health and whole health, are you referring to acupuncture, mindfulness, and nutritional interventions, or what else is covered under that umbrella?
So whole health is a much broader concept than integrative medicine or lifestyle medicine or functional medicine or any of those other terms you might hear. It does incorporate those things when there's good evidence, to show that there are value in those areas. But it's a broader concept really that harks back to sort of the continuity primary care the specialty of family medicine really was born out of. I'm a family physician and was inspired by those early founders that took the biopsychosocial model, as it was talked about at that time, which was really a holistic model, developed a way of caring for people that addressed all the core aspects, mind, body, social, and spirit, and had the capability to do that with expert generalist care. And then tested it, tried it out and tested it, and proved that it actually improved health, lowered costs, and people liked it a lot better.
Well, you're singing from our songbook when we think about not just family medicine, but primary care and Barbara Starfield and those original tenants, and certainly all the work that community health centers were built upon with community and social determinants. But back to your book, How Healing Works, you wrote about four decades of experience and research that led you to say that 80% of healing occurs organically outside of the actual healthcare system. So talk with us about how you describe how one activates the healing process and what steps particularly can the patient take with or without the guidance of the healthcare provider.
Well, I think, the data is very clear that most of actual health does not come from going to your doctor and getting a diagnosis or a treatment, although that is important in those areas. So how do you activate that healing? Well, just think about it for a minute. You wouldn't be around unless your body was continually healing. Because we are bombarded by stresses, by traumas, by infections, by, all kinds of things that want to break us down once we're born. And if we didn't have a robust inherent healing and repair capacity and the ability to kind of reintegrate, come back to coherence, we wouldn't be around. So the idea, this concept is captured in the term that I like to use. It was originally developed by a psychologist, but I broaden it to medicine in general. It's called salutogenesis. So we all know what pathogenesis is, right? Okay, the disease productions processes. I studied in medical school from the textbook of pathology and pathogenesis. But in parallel with that, simultaneously always going on is the repair of that process, the reintegration, the reordering of those components, the return to wholeness, as I like to say. And so this salutogenic process, we've studied, there's a lot of data on it, but we haven't incorporated it into our day-to-day practice. And we can talk about how you can do that in very simple and easy ways.
One of the challenges, Margaret, we see in our practices is around pain. And, you know, research shows that 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. I'm wondering, do you recommend that healthcare providers start treatment with non-pharmacological approaches? We often hear patients really want medication in some ways because the standards were we always asked about pain. But tell us how you handle this particular area.
Yeah, so let me give you an example of that. I see patients in a whole person or integrative chronic pain management clinic within a family medicine training program. And these are, so we see a lot of patients who have had the standard approaches to pain. Many of them are on medications, have had lots of procedures, et cetera. I'll give you an example of one fellow by the name of Joe had chronic back pain, very common problem, a very costly type of thing. Creates a lot of suffering. And he'd had lots of injections. He'd been on and off opioids. He had medications, physical therapy. He'd had a couple surgeries, actually, for his back. And yet he still had chronic back pain. Each of those things would give him some relief, sometimes temporarily, sometimes a bit. But his chronic pain persisted. And so we sat down with him and we asked him, okay, what are the inherent healing processes that you do? We didn't exactly term it that way. I simply asked him, first of all, what matters to you? Why do you actually want to get engaged in the treatment of your own pain? He was very clear. The pain prevented him from driving several hours down to see his grandchildren and getting down on the floor and playing with them. He couldn't do that. And he wanted to do that. This was the driver. This is what mattered to him. So that's number one. Number two, we needed to be able to tap into things that helped him do that on his own, his inherent healing capacity. So we asked him a couple questions about that. And as it turns out, he found that heat and stretching actually worked quite a bit. But again, it worked temporarily. And he'd go to physical therapy and he didn't have a way of actually engaging in heat. So we had to actually set up a system whereby he could begin to do this at home. He got a hot tub that he got into and he did some stretching exercises. But we needed more than that. We needed to get his core function working so that he could get down on the floor and play with his grandchildren. That's the primary what he wanted to do. So we ran him up to the physical therapist. I took him up there personally, and we sat down with the physical therapist and said, you know, we're not here to treat his back pain. We're to get him able to get up and down off the floor. Now, that hurt. All right. But he was motivated to do that. So we adjusted the core exercises. He went and started to do those along with the heat. Now, he had some other things. He had sleep issues. He had stress management issues, et cetera. And so we had to help support those processes that we know facilitate healing and can mitigate chronic disease and chronic pain, including that. He did that for about 6 or 7 weeks. He started to get better. And about 8 weeks later, okay, he came in to see me and he said, hey, doc, guess what? I just drove down and I got down on the floor and I played with my grandchildren. He was ecstatic. Okay. Now, it was hard for him. He had to go through, you know, a lot, but he was willing to do it because this was what was important for him in his life. And it was different from all the pain treatment procedures he'd had over the last 15 years. Now he was hooked. He was motivated. He was engaged in his own self-care, his own health, self-healing capacity had been tapped into that. He saw the results of that. And then he said, what else do you got, doc? What else can you do to improve my health care in those areas? So that's an example where we tapped into his own inherent healing capacity, gave him a stimulus that then, you know, actually engaged that in those areas. But mostly we developed a relationship with him that allowed us to understand and him to understand what was most important in his life and then seek to get at those goals in our healthcare plan. And that's whole person care.
Well, that is a great example of listening to the patient, making sure you know what the problem is from their point of view, and also bringing in the physical therapy people who are such great members of the team. I want to talk about a situation that often just throws people right into a spin, and that's the diagnosis of cancer, really any kind of cancer. And you're the co-author of Healing in Cancer, A Guide to Whole Person Care. That certainly emphasizes lifestyle and emotional well-being along, of course, with traditional treatments. Tell us about this work and how would you like people to understand this interaction?
Well, I had the great opportunity to partner with an oncologist who works in the VA, Alyssa McManaman, general oncologist, beautiful individual, very holistic in thinking and caring for her patients. And so we partnered up to really look at the data, okay, look at the evidence about how people improve their quality and their length of life when they're diagnosed with cancer in those areas. And we know from what are called the hallmarks of cancer, which is the biological drivers of cancer, huge amount of science that has emerged over the last 20 years in those areas, that the underlying drivers are multifactorial, and they involve basic wellness components, okay? Inflammation, the microbiome, immunity, which is now an exploding area in terms of the treatment of cancer. But when somebody gets diagnosed with cancer and then they go in and see their oncologist and oncology team, the entire thing is almost all focused on killing the cancer cells. And yet we know that those cancers emerge in that microenvironment and the macroenvironment around that. So really care for the cancer person, the person with cancer and the cancer itself requires we pay attention to the person, the whole person, not just kill the cancer cell. Yes, do that, but make sure we pay attention to that. For example, exercise. When's the last time your oncologist, if you've had cancers, had said, well, tell me what you're doing for exercise? Or maybe if they were really enlightened, they'd just give you a pamphlet and say, well, you do need to keep active, okay, in those areas. But people need support and specifically customized exercise for their stage and endpoint in cancer. And it's now been shown that exercise has huge impact on both quality and length of life. Social support, the same thing. Social support mitigates stress, that alters inflammation. Inflammation modifies the drivers in the tumor microenvironment. They also help people feel better in those areas. So social support is very important. And if you compare cancer patients with high social support compared to low social support, there's a 25% mortality difference in that, okay? But who asks, do you have social support in those areas? We should all be asking that, bringing our teams together to get those who do not have good social support up, and they will do better in those areas. So that's what the book is about. It outlines a lot of those underlying drivers of whole person care. We have those tools available. Especially in academic centers or larger medical centers, but even in community centers, there are often tools available using supportive care, what's called supportive care, palliative care, psycho-oncology, physical therapists we just talked about in those areas that are properly trained, stress management, sleep management, et cetera. And so these things need to be routinely incorporated into cancer care. And that's what the book is about. And it actually gives step-by-step guides on how teams can provide that kind of care.
Well, I want to pull the thread on how teams can provide the care. I want to go back to Joe and his grandchild and wondering if he made the second and third, maybe the fourth trip down there, or did he get thrown off?
He was hooked.
And then maybe about the team, because you needed a willing patient, but you needed a willing team to work together. Big academic centers, but a lot of medicine is delivered in rural parts of the world. How are you thinking about the spread of this, training that next generation? Certainly, as Margaret said earlier, family practice dear to our hearts, but not everybody is a family practitioner. So walk us through how this model is going to scale up and what you're doing through your book and your talks about helping train that generation of teams that can really engage those willing patients like Joe.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This isn't just about primary care. This kind of whole person care is needed in every specialty across the spectrum in those areas. And there's some great examples, your example of pain management, where orthopedic systems, orthopedic clinics actually are embedding now whole person care, you know, before they do surgery, for example, in pain management, knee replacements, hip replacements, things like that. And their patients do much better with that. So there's lots of examples on that. So how do these teams get trained up in that? Well, there's several examples of how to do that, guides on how to do that and how to spread it. Again, in primary care, the National Academy of Sciences and Medicine had a report came out in 2021 called Implementing High Quality Primary Care. And it described in detail how to do whole person care and what the teams look like, what the payment issues look like, what the training issues, the technology components that are required for that. And they're gradually implementing that, you know, in the nation. I hope CMS and others are paying close attention to it because it was a very detailed description. Another example is what's going on in the VA. And I mentioned my co-author of the cancer book. There is a program that's spreading in the VA called Whole Health, which takes these kinds of frameworks and is now delivering it across specialties within the VA at centers of excellence and rolling it out even in to remote kind of clinical centers that the VA provides care for in those areas. And that was summarized in another National Academy of Medicine report called Achieving Whole Health. And it described what was happening in the VA, and then it showed examples that were going on around the country and even around other places in the world of how this was happening. So it is out there and available, and we now need to drive the entire system to begin to do more of that. So we tested some simple tools out that anybody in a rural setting or an individual practice can utilize immediately. They're on our website. We adapted some of them from the VA. We tested them out in 16 community health centers and some specialty centers. In a subsequent test, 13 oncology centers around the country in a learning network where these tools were brought in and began to be implemented. Some of these tools are very simple. They're on our website. There's technologies that allow you to do them and get them into the electronic medical record. One is called the Personal Health Inventory. Okay. This is a simple two-page questionnaire you give to patients ahead of the visit, and it asks them, number one, what's important in their life? Like, you know, Joe found out what was important to him, and what are the underlying drivers that he is ready for, that he's ready to engage in, that can facilitate these inherent healing capacities? And then those then become part of the plan. Okay, they become of the healthcare plan, then they become integrated into those areas. And those 16 centers showed that they could be done within large centers, small community centers, even individual practices, if they organize their services around that and actually began to embed them in their practice improvement processes. So that's what we recommend to people.
Well, I'm so glad that you referenced the Whole Health Program and Veteran Affairs. We were speaking about that just a few moments ago. I have a dear colleague, a nurse practitioner colleague, who's engaged in that work in one of the centers. And what was so interesting to me in discussing it is that the Veteran Affairs folks are really taking advantage of the full continuum: mindfulness, meditation, breathing, Reiki, chiropractic, nutrition, everything that patients need. And, you know, one might say it's a stereotype, but if ever there was a group of people I might not have thought would be amenable to mindfulness-based meditation or breathing, it might have been our veterans.
Tell me how you
think in this institutional setting, in Veteran Affairs, such an important part of our healthcare system, Whole Health has been able to take root at the institutional level, the training level, the service level, and the research level, in a way that maybe not so much beyond Veteran Affairs yet. What is unique about Veteran Affairs that you think has been able to make such progress?
Well, I happen to know a bit about the history of this. I was involved in it. There was a lot of this going on already within the VA, because people that take care of patients over, you know, periods of time and have a philosophy, have a concept that they need to take care of the whole person, which the VA had, you know, this is not just, you know, treating them, but the system does. They were already starting to do this. And the institute that I ran, foundation that I ran for several years, was facilitating calls and discussions across the VA in many of these areas every month for about 3 years in order for them to talk to each other, learn what was going on, seeing what the critical mass is. And they began to talk to those in policy, Congress, and the people that control the budget and the leadership within the VA, and say, you know, we need to enhance this. We need to make sure we put in more salutogenic resources in those areas. And so actually there was a federal law that said, let's create these whole health centers of excellence. And embedded into that was the support for salutogenic services that any, veteran and any healthcare team could access. And then on top of that, the tremendous research capability that the VA already has, right, and has had for years, to be able to track that and look at that, as well as the practice and improvement component. So by inserting those concepts into that and providing some additional salutogenic support, they were able to actually build this program and spread it now across the VA.
Oh, we've been talking about the VA. You mentioned earlier CMS. There are six months into a new administration. What are your thoughts about how the VA's leadership is shaping up, and also the leadership at CMS? And certainly we have a powerhouse in Secretary Kennedy and HHS, who's got a lot of things on his mind. And how are you framing this up in the context of the work that you're doing and the work that you're trying to promote? Are you seeing kindred spirits there, or have they taken a U-turn?
Well, I think the language is very aligned with what we're talking about. There is a philosophy and a language that says we need to reduce chronic disease. We need to take care of whole people. We need to tap into things that aren't just of corporate interest, for example, that might make money for the industry, but actually facilitate the healing. So the concepts are there. We haven't yet seen the policies that would actually drive this across the country. I think there are ways to do that. I think there's examples. We've talked about some of those in those areas, but we haven't seen those core processes for tapping into the inherent healing capacity, which does this, okay, access yet. They're still looking at a variety of things in the environment and, trying to go after reducing costs in pharmaceuticals, reducing the food industry influences type of thing, all of which were laudable, but they're not getting at those five core things: sleep, exercise, nutrition, stress management, and social support, and the spiritual component yet that are these inherent drivers that we've just been talking about here in those areas. And so structuring coverage, go back to CMS, structuring coverage that allows models, these types of models within community settings, and then tracking their ability to improve health, reduce chronic disease, and capture costs. That redesign of the healthcare system, which we have lots of examples on, and then putting some resources, shifting resources, is what we still have to see. We supported our foundation that I run right now, Healing Works Foundation, supported another study in the National Academy of Medicine on how you would shift investments to drive that spread. Okay, beyond the, it's called Valuing America's Health, and it went through a detailed examination of where are we putting money that's not creating health, and where is there good evidence if we put more investment, it would drive health along a whole person framework. And so that's a great guideline. If I would recommend one thing to them, I'd say take a look at that and use that as a blueprint
if it's not going to come out of the federal government, will states be the engine of innovation here? Where will this happen? Because it's really important to keep the momentum. The feds may be ceding this to the states. Do you see anything that suggests that we have some enlightened state leaders?
we do have a number of enlightened state leaders. I just got off the phone yesterday, actually, with the National Association of State Policy folks who are tracking and working with states to do this. And there are a number of states around the country that have been doing this for quite a long time in different ways, in different models. And I think that if the federal government just pulls out of this rather than, you know, trying to enhance it, we're going to see them step up. They're going to have to step up to take care of their own health care and their populations. It is a state federal thing. They're not, you know, even if the federal government says we don't want to be the ones providing all the support in this area, they're still always going to be a major player in those areas. So state and feds have to get together and begin to work out how we're going to reduce chronic disease and make America healthy again, to use their term.
Well, you know, you referenced the National Academy report towards implementing high quality primary care. Couldn't agree with you more. One of the seminal documents and core in it to that team was the presence of the community health workers and particularly their role in helping to address the social determinants of health. And if you want to talk about stress sending you into a tailspin, I think we can all imagine not enough food to feed your kids, no way to get to the job because the car broke down, you don't have money to fix it, losing your housing, all of these things are stress at an immense level. I'm curious about your foundation now in terms of the research you're doing. Are you looking at the contribution of the social determinants of health to stress and poor health outcomes in the same way you've looked at the other factors, you know, diet, sleep, nutrition, et cetera? It seems like this is such a pervasive challenge in our society right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is key. And if we can't do it with populations that don't have those resources, it's very, very difficult to do it across the nation. So we've been working for a number of years now with a safety net hospital system up in Queens, New York, called the Jamaica Medical Health System. It's the major safety net hospital within Queens. Lots of people with social determinant challenges, as you can imagine. Medicare, Medicaid, or no insurance is mostly what they take care of. 133 languages they have to be responsible for translating for the patients that they care for. And we've been working with them to help them build a whole person care approach, like we've talked, for those patients. And especially identifying those at the highest risk for chronic illness and high costs in those areas. And they've created an advanced primary care system, ambulatory system that they've tested out now using these same principles. If social determinants are a key issue, they integrate with the community to provide those things if that's what arises to the top and what matters most important to that particular patient. So they have this coordinated, integrated service component that works closely with the community. They've trained their health navigators to be health coaches and community health workers. Many of them are already community health workers in those areas to provide community ambulatory care for these high risk patients. And they have shown, even in a matter of a year and a half, marked reductions in emergency room use, specialty use, chronic disease, and chronic costs. They've saved close to $15 million in a relatively small population by providing this type of risk-based whole person care.
You know, I think our listeners would be interested in your journey. We only have a few minutes here, but how did you pivot to include this integrative whole health approach? And maybe just tell us a little bit about the storyline.
So I was a standard trained family physician working in the military. I had a scholarship and I did my residency in the military. And then I worked for 20 years in the military where the philosophy is not just treat the disease, but keep our service members and their families functional, right? Human performance optimization. So I had to pay attention to the health promotion and the prevention components and did a lot of things within that system during my career in that area, including run clinics that could do this type of thing. And so while I was doing that, I was running a small hospital in Germany for the military folks during my assignment. And we had to work closely with the German medical community because they did our transportation, our ambulance transportation for those that we needed because we were quite remote. And I learned that they were using things that I had never heard of before, such as an herb for depression, the number one prescription item for depression, St. John's Wort. Acupuncture was routinely used for pain and pain management. Homeopathy, which I thought, this is crazy. What is that? Okay. But I remember one physician gave me a homeopathic cream, said, hey, try this out on your next patient with back pain. I gave it to him. They tried it. It worked. I said, oh, God, I need to find out about this. Okay. So they had a bigger medical bag than I did. All right. And most of those fit into the so-called complementary medicine or integrative medicine category. And that got me interested in the science and the research, eventually led me to Walter Reed to do research training, train others in research, and then to the NIH, where we looked at the so-called complementary and alternative medicine components, the research components. And now, I'm glad to say many of those, have emerged as effective, and others have been shown not to be effective.
Okay? Arnica is in all of our backpacks.
So we now can draw from that and begin to incorporate that into care. And that's now called integrative practice. But you got to go beyond that to the social determinants, to biopsychosocial components, as we just discussed, to really do whole person care.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jonas, for joining us today. And thank you to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and share your thoughts and comments about this program. We'd love to hear from you. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.